Hey everyone, welcome to the Pitch Talks podcast. On this episode, we're going to head to 918 Bathurst in Toronto. And this panel was our second panel of the night on our last show, November 17th. This features the president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City, Bob Kendrick. He came up to have a one-on-one chat with Jeff Blair from Sportsnet, and frankly, Bob stole the show. Be sure to give this a full listen. And also, if you want to check out some of our future shows, we just announced our next one, December 15th, which will be at the Rivoli in Toronto. We also have shows in Tavistock, Ontario, in Barrie, and a few other announcements coming up, including a special announcement. So be sure to head over to homestandsports.com, subscribe to our newsletter, follow on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. We got an announcement coming up that you probably don't want to miss. Enjoy this podcast and stay tuned for a few others.
This is a real pleasure for me. About 1999, I was in Kansas City on an assignment, and I was covering an NFL game, and I went to the Negro League Museum. And ever since then, anytime people ask me, you know, bucket list baseball, what do? I always tell them that the Negro League Museum, first of all, it's in Kansas City, which is one of the real great towns in the United States.
Best barbecue on the face of the planet.
Barbecue, music, and baseball. I mean, the Holy Trinity. And you know, I found it important because I'm not a big museum guy because I'm old, but I like going to places where you feel as if you're enveloped by history. And the way it's designed, the approach they've taken to it is, if you're a baseball fan, it's you know, given the choice of spending a day there or Cooperstown, no contest. I'm going to the Negro League Museum. So I'm just want to throw that out. It's really a special place, and if you get a chance as a baseball fan, you should go there. I mean, one of the things we're going to talk about tonight is something that I don't think we know as Canadians, but you know, I think we associate, when you talk about Canada, Negro Leagues, people say, oh, Canada, that's where Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier. In point of fact, and we'll talk about this, this country really holds a special place in the heart of a lot of people, did hold a special place in the hearts of a lot of people who are in the Negro Leagues Hall of Fame. There were a lot of people, a lot of players, who made a lot of money playing in places, by the standards of those days, playing in places like Winnipeg, Carmen, Manitou, Manitoba, Weyburn, Saskatchewan. Yeah. And we're talking guys who are in the Hall of Fame. So we'll talk about that and kind of Canada's role in the whole culture of the Negro Leagues. But, Bob, thank you very much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Tell us a little bit just about the history of the Negro Leagues Museum, how it came about. And it went through a couple of years of hard times, didn't it?
It's an incredible story when we look at the creation of our museum in Kansas City, how we got started. We're as grassroots an organization as you will ever encounter. We started, guys, in a little one-room office, Jeff, about as big as this area that we're sitting in. And it had a conference room table, and at that time there were a number of local Negro Leaguers that called Kansas City home, including the late, great John Buck O'Neill. And these guys met in that little office, and they took turns paying the monthly rent to keep the little office open. And that's how we got started. And from there, we've now grown to become America's national Negro Leagues Museum. But when we started, our little humble origins, when we started, no one gave our museum any chance of succeeding. We were, number one, we were going to build this museum in an area, historic 18th and Vine. Mm-hmm. 18th and Vine, to give you an idea of what 18th and Vine. 18th and Vine was a cultural crossroads where jazz and baseball intersected. It was a mecca for music, great baseball, but like a lot of urban areas, it had died. And the demise of the Negro Leagues had a lot to do with why those black communities kind of died. And so we decided we would build a museum right there in the very spot where Rube Foster, I think you see Rube Foster on the slide, right around the corner from where Rube Foster founded the Negro Leagues in Kansas City in 1920. So some of our most ardent supporters said, you're crazy. No one will come there. There was nothing else there outside of the old Lincoln Building where we started the museum. Buck O'Neill, for all of his infinite wisdom, said, this is the place we will build this museum. And as a result of us building there, the area has been resurrected. It is now vibrant. There are people living there. There are commercial developments coming there. And so Buck was right on. Was it the best business move for us at that time? Probably not. But it was never a self-serving proposition for our museum. It was about what was going to be good for that community, and we've been able to grow along with the community. And, you know, we're so excited about our place there at Historic 18th and Vine and the role that the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum has had in doing exactly what Negro Leagues Baseball did. Wherever you had successful black baseball, you had thriving black economies. And here we are now, you know, almost 100 years later doing the exact same thing for that community.
And in terms of funding for the museum, does Major League Baseball contribute money to that?
A little bit. We try to get more.
Right.
Yeah, we're working on it.
The reason I ask that is because I would think that this current commissioner is probably, shall we say, more approachable than his predecessor.
Well, I think the timing is ripe, and he has already been to the museum, came and experienced, brought his wife, stayed for well over almost 2 hours, walking around. We had a great time. Now with Tony Clark, who's a dear friend of the museum, a good personal friend of mine, serving as the head of Major League Baseball's Players Association. I think the time is as good now for us to get together, sit around the table, and come up with a way that we can create a sustaining level of support from Major League Baseball. So they've been supportive here and there with events and programs that we've done, but hopefully we'll get to the position where there's a sustaining kind of gift from baseball.
Now, Bob, if you mention Negro Leagues to most baseball fans, I'm sure their first response would be, oh, that's where Jackie Robinson played before he came to the majors, Satchel Paige, Willie Mays, we talked about that, Ernie Banks. But, you know, I was just going to say, that kind of gives short shrift to the league, doesn't it? Because, as we found out today when we had you on my show, I mean, there were cities where the Negro League teams outdrew the major league teams, which I didn't know.
Well, you know, and I think that's the thing. And it's so interesting because even when we talk about Jackie Robinson, a lot of people didn't know that his career began in the Negro League. I think they think Jackie just walked out of nowhere and started playing professional baseball. But he really learned how to play in Kansas City with the great Kansas City Monarchs in 1945. The great Hilton Smith, Hall of Famer, is responsible for recommending Jackie Robinson to J.L. Wilkinson. And Wilkinson signs Robinson under Hilton Smith's advice. Now, little did Wilkie know, he was signing the player that was going to put him out of business. Mm-hmm. But that's a whole other story. Hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about that. There were so many great players. And obviously, we know the marquee names. You know, they gave me this. I brought this PowerPoint thing. I rarely ever use PowerPoint. But for the sake of this, I wanted to at least put some images up. One of those great players being the great Oscar Charleston, whom the late, great Buck O'Neill would say, guys, without hesitation, the greatest baseball player he'd ever seen. Now, he believed Willie Mays to be the greatest Major League Baseball player, and most people concur, because Mays could beat you any way in which you could be beaten. He could beat you with his arm, with his legs, with his bat, with his glove. And, of course, Mays' illustrious career began in the Negro League with the Birmingham Black Barons. But old Buck believed that man on the slide, Oscar Charleston, to be the greatest baseball player he ever saw. Oscar Charleston in 1921 led the Negro Leagues in home runs, triples, doubles, stolen bases, and batting average in the same season. If you were going to compare him to Major League contemporaries, he had the defensive abilities of Tris Speaker, the tenacity of Ty Cobb, and the bat of Babe Ruth rolled into one dynamic package. And old Buck says he never saw a center fielder who could go back on a ball the way Charleston could. The old-timers say, you remember when Mays makes the great catch in the polo grounds? Number one, you could only make that catch in the polo grounds because he ran a country mile to make that catch. The throw was probably better than the catch. But everybody was excited about that catch. All the Negro League players say, had that been Oscar Charleston, he'd have been waiting for that to come down. You know, that's how good Oscar Charleston was. Buck would always say he had uncanny instincts. So he played a very shallow center field, but just with the crack of the bat, seemed to know where the ball was going. And he also says one of the strongest men he ever saw in his life. He says Oscar Charleston, believe it or not, could put a baseball between both palms and turn the leather on the baseball. Just freakishly strong. Yeah, so, you know, he's one of those guys. I brought this slide of the great Chet Brewer. And Chet Brewer was kind of like a baseball nomad. He played, oh, God, he pitched for 24 years, played in 10 different countries, 44 of the 48 continental United States. Of course, played here in Canada, the first black player to play in Mexico. He would wet it up a little bit. Of course, spitball was legal then, so they were doing a little some things that they probably can't do now. Of course, they do it still, but that's a whole other story. But, you know, he was an amazing pitcher, as I say on the slide, among the top 20 pitchers in Negro Leagues history. He hails from Leavenworth, Kansas, just right down the road from the museum, my man Buck Leonard. And Buck Leonard, if you've not been to the museum, he's at first base on the field of legends at the museum where we have these life-size statues. Buck Leonard was called the Black Lou Gehrig. And of course, but Buck Leonard, by most accounts, is the greatest first baseman to have ever played this game. He was compared to Gehrig, but he had greater defensive abilities than Gehrig. And the old-timers in the Negro League still say the greatest fastball hitter this sport has ever seen. They say sneaking a fastball past Buck Leonard was like trying to sneak sunrise past the rooster. Mm-hmm. You couldn't do it. He sit there red and would not miss. Buck tells a great story. He says old Satchel was on the mound, and Leonard was a left-handed first baseman, line drive hitter with power. And they're playing the Homestead Grays, and Leonard's at the plate, and Buck is playing first base for the Monarchs. And he says Satchel had thrown him three or four consecutive off-speed pitches that Leonard had ripped foul down the first base line. And he says Satchel's going to try to get a fastball past Buck Leonard. He says Leonard hit the ball so hard that it ripped the webbing out of his glove. He says he calls time. He goes over to the mound. And he says, hey, man, don't you throw him another fastball today. You're going to get me killed over here. You know, that was Buck Leonard. Buck Leonard hit over 400 when he was 40 years old. But he was that Negro Leagues player that was too old. You know, baseball didn't really want him, and he knew he was too old to go into the major leagues, so he didn't get that opportunity.
One of the things, the other things I didn't know about this is Negro Leagues teams played in ballparks that major league teams played in and owned. So here you had a situation where white owners wouldn't allow Negro League players into the game, but it's okay if the team plays in their ballpark and they make money off of it. Tell us a little bit about that and also about the crowds at those games, because you made the point, again, for a lot of us who don't know this, that the major league games were segregated in some of the cities. They were segregated just as society was. But in the Negro League games, which, as we said, in some cases were better attended, you would have white fans sitting with black fans. There'd be no segregation.
No segregation except in the Deep South.
Except, yeah.
Yeah, you know, in Birmingham, we weren't going to sit together under no circumstances. But, you know.
And there was chicken wire. There was separating the fans. There was a cage.
At major league games, typically if they allowed black fans in to watch a major league game, we were separated by that chicken wire barrier, which is one of the reasons we use a chicken wire backstop that basically separates our guests when they come to the museum from that field of legends. Mm-hmm. So the chicken wire is in many respects symbolic. So black fans were typically relegated to the left or right field lines, and we were separated from white fans with chicken wire who sat in the rest of the ballpark. But at Negro League games, we really didn't have that because, number one, they were renting the ballparks from major league teams. America, as you well know, is a capitalistic society. So these teams were making money off of Negro Leagues baseball. There were only a couple of Negro League teams that had their own stadiums. You know, Gus Greenlee in Pittsburgh bought Greenlee Field, paid $100,000 in 1931 to build Greenlee Field. And in Memphis, you had the Martin brothers who had their own stadium. So really the Negro Leagues would have to wait for Major League Baseball to set their schedules before they could then go in and set their schedules, because they would have to wait for the major league team to be on the road to get access to the stadium, which is one of the reasons that J.L. Wilkinson, who owned the Monarchs, started night baseball in the Negro Leagues some 5 years before they ever played a night game in the major leagues. They were playing night games in the Negro Leagues, and nobody knew it. You know, everybody says that the first professional night baseball game, 1935, Crosley Field, Cincinnati Reds versus the Philadelphia Phillies. Well, the history book is wrong. The first professional night baseball game took place in 1930, and it featured our very own Kansas City Monarchs. Wilkie literally mortgaged everything he had to pioneer night baseball. Portable generated light towers. I think I've got a slide with the portable generated light towers. Mm-hmm. So not only could they play a night game in Kansas City, they loaded them on the truck and brought them all the way to Canada with the House of David. Anybody familiar with the House of David? House of David was an all-white religious sect based out of Benton Harbor, Michigan, characterized by their very long hair, very long whiskers. They were mimicking David from the Bible. They play a great role in black baseball because they would barnstorm all over the country with and against the Kansas City Monarchs, most notably, other Negro League teams as well. And one of my favorite stories, House of David, 1934, they're in the Denver Post Tournament, and the House of David recruited Satchel Paige to pitch for them. Now, Satchel, wanting to look like his white teammates. I'm telling you, you can't make this stuff up. It's too good. You can't make it up. Satchel dressed in a fake wig and a fake red beard and would strike out 51 hitters in three games. The House of David would win the $7,500 prize money. And if you know Satchel, you know he got a large percentage of that $7,500 prize money.
Now, in addition to white fans, there were white owners, weren't there?
There were. You know, in 1920, when Rube Foster organized the Negro Leagues in Kansas City, there were eight independent black baseball team owners, one white owner, J.O. Wilkinson, who owned the Kansas City Monarchs. But when white businessmen saw that there was money to be made in black baseball, guess what? They got into black baseball, the business of black baseball. This was primarily created in 1923 when the Eastern Colored League was formed, 1924, your very first Negro Leagues World Series, the Kansas City Monarchs against the Hilldale Daisies out of Darby, Pennsylvania. The Monarchs would win that World Series, becoming our city's first professional sports team champion of any kind in 1924, led by the legendary Hall of Famer Wilbur Bullet Joe Rogan. Yeah, Joe Rogan was bad. Joe Rogan was a pitcher, hence the name Bullet Joe. But when he wasn't pitching, he played the outfield and hit cleanup. Yeah.
He'd make a lot of money this year.
Oh, you couldn't pay
this
him.
Time. He'd make he'd be a pretty good free agent. My guess is Scott Boras would represent him if he was a free agent. You know, Bob. Nobody denies that the desegregation of baseball and society was a good thing, but. Ultimately, it kind of led to the death of the Negro Leagues, didn't it?
Of course. You know, it's bittersweet from that respect. Because honestly, I don't know if the African-American community realized what we were losing when we lost the Negro Leagues. It created a bit of disenfranchisement within the economic structure. So it was good morally, it was good socially, but it was devastating economically because the Negro Leagues were, you have to keep in mind, the third largest black-owned business in this country during that era of American segregation. It only trailed black-owned insurance companies who emerged during that era and would insure African Americans more than the 10 or 15 cents that the white insurance companies would insure us. Back then, the white insurance companies would insure me just enough to bury me. Well, black-owned insurance companies came about, not only insured my livelihood, but insured my stock, insured my crop, insured my home, and as a result, made millions of dollars. Next was a woman by the name of Madam C.J. Walker. And see, I know there's a sister in the back. I know she knows who Madam C.J. Walker is. But in case the rest of you have not heard that name, Madam C.J. Walker would become this country's first self-made businesswoman millionaire of any skin color. You know how she did it? Doing black hair. Yeah, doing black hair. Madam C.J. had schools of cosmetology in every major urban city in this country, becoming the first woman to earn $1 million with a business structure. Next was Negro Leagues baseball. And if old Buck was here tonight, he'd tell you all you needed was a bus, two sets of uniforms, and you'd have 20 of the greatest athletes who ever lived. But with the when Robinson breaks the color barrier, black fans left the Negro Leagues to see how their black stars were going to fare. And it's a natural curiosity because everybody had been waiting on this. And in the African-American community, Robinson's breaking of the color barrier was equivalent to the first man landing on the moon. Mainstream America had no idea that this was happening, and it really didn't register as much as it did, obviously, in the African-American community. And so all of a sudden, all of those black businesses that had been supported by black baseball, they died. They died. And so it is bittersweet from that respect. Yeah, absolutely.
Of course, we know that Jackie Robinson, you know, I guess effectively, if you want to call it that, broke the color barrier with the Montreal Royals, which, and you got to tell that story about J.L. Wilkinson. He didn't make a lot of money off that deal, did he?
No,
I'll let you tell that story before I continue here.
Okay.
Tell them
well,
about that.
You know, Jackie Robinson, as I mentioned, was playing there in Kansas City. And quite frankly, we have World War II to really thank for the ushering of integration in baseball in this country. Because you're absolutely right. These baseball had been integrated a long time ago in these other countries where they were going to Spanish-speaking countries and Negro League players and Major League players, as well as those native players from those different regions, were playing baseball together. So there was no doubt about the fact that these men could play because a superstar major leaguer had watched them play. So when Branch Rickey makes his move to go sign Jackie Robinson, he literally took him away from J.L. Wilkinson. And Wilkinson could not fight back. See, Wilkie never got paid a dime for Jackie Robinson, a man he had under contract. But Wilkinson couldn't fight back because Wilkinson was white. Yeah, and so if Wilkinson, who had made his entire living in black baseball, and Buck would say of J.L. Wilkinson that he was the first white man he ever met without any prejudice, and Wilkie had made his entire living in black baseball, so now if this white man stands up and protests against what every black person in this country had been waiting for, he's going to be out of business anyway. They're going to turn his back. They're going to turn their back on his business, and so publicly, he said all the right things. Mm-hmm. Privately, he's seething. But he wasn't seething because a black man was going to get a chance to play in the major leagues. He was seething because this black man that you're about to take away from me, you're going to put me out of business. And he sold his business interest the very next year to his business partner, T.Y. Baird. Now, the funny story about T.Y. Baird, T.Y. Baird was a known Ku Klux Klansman from Kansas City. I told you, you can't make this stuff up. So if there are any aspiring screenwriters out there, come to Kansas City. It's a lot of stuff there waiting for you. And so Wilkinson couldn't protest. He loses Jackie. He knew that the business of baseball was going to die. Well, a few weeks later, Bill Veeck goes to Effie Manley to go get Larry Doby. Effie Manley says, hell no. If you want him, you will pay me. They paid her $15,000 for a player who will become a future Hall of Famer, so it was a bargain. But now this set the tenor for other Negro League owners to basically start selling off their assets and to try to get something out of this before the business of black baseball died.
So in addition to Jackie Robinson of Montreal, this is something I talked about at the start of our presentation. In addition to Montreal, Canada played and has a special place in the heart of a lot of Negro League players, doesn't it? Because as the Negro Leagues ran into financial trouble, a lot of black players moved up to Canada to play. Mm-hmm. I made the point, you can go to small towns in Manitoba, Saskatchewan. You can go to town in Manitoba, 4,000. Go to Saskatchewan, you go through their archives, you'll see pictures of their baseball teams, and there will be 9-10 African Americans or Cubans on the team. And I come up with some names. Willie Wells, a terrific Hall of Famer, a relation to Vernon Wells, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
He played for 4 years with the Winnipeg Buffaloes. Satchel Paige pitched in Minot, North Dakota, pitched in Manitoba, Saskatchewan. And this is when these guys were, I mean, they were still good players.
Yeah.
And I had a chance to interview a fellow named Walter Lee Bubblegum Gibbons, who is a member of the Manitoba Baseball Hall of Fame. another Negro League player, and he told me he made more money in 1 year playing in Manitoba than he made in 2 years in the Negro Leagues.
Yeah.
And he got a lot of money, and as he said, I could go anywhere. I could go to the restaurant in the town. I would live with families. So tell these people a little bit about that part, because I think as Canadians, we don't, and Canadian baseball fans, we don't sort of treasure that as much as we should.
And you should. And you should, because that connection is great and is significant and very meaningful, because there had been a longstanding history of barnstorming into Canada, you know, well before Robinson breaks the color barrier. And in many ways, Canada became a refuge for those black baseball players because they were just treated so differently. They were welcomed. And as you mentioned, they were free when they came here north of the border. And back at home, you're subjected to Jim Crow law, the same as Arturo mentioned when they went to the Caribbean countries and other Spanish-speaking countries. They were free. Monty Irvin speaks so eloquently of saying he never felt more freer in his life than when he went to Mexico for the first time. And so many of those players experienced that same level of freedom when they came to Canada. But as Jeff alluded, once Robinson breaks the color barrier and Negro League players start transitioning into the major leagues, the older Negro League player basically got put out of business. So the Negro Leagues didn't want them anymore because they couldn't sell them to the major leagues, and the major leagues didn't want them because they were too old. So they came back to Canada to revive their baseball playing careers, you know, until they just truly became too old to play. But so many of those guys had fond memories of their time in Canada.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I told the story in my show this morning a little bit about when I interviewed Walter, who's a lovely man, and yes, he does have a bubblegum machine in his living room, an old bubblegum machine. He was making the point about how he went over to the Korean War, came back, and he knew that he was going to go to Canada to play because the economic issues of the Negro Leagues. And he got on a train in the States. I want to say it was in Georgia, it was Fort Benning or one of those places, but he got in the train, got his uniform on, gets in the train, train goes to Chicago. He's going to get off the train in Chicago, and he's going to take a CN or CP train up to Canada. And he's got his uniform on. So he gets on the train in Canada, the Canadian train, sits down. Porter comes up and says, "Excuse me, sir, you can't sit here." So he's, okay, Jim Crow. But the porter touches him on the shoulder and says, "No, military personnel are sitting up in the front car." And he told the story about how first time he'd ever had anybody say to him that because he was black, you were going up here.
To the front.
You're going to the front. You're not going to the back. You're going to the front. And I mean, it's just, like I said, I think it's an important part of history because I lived in those small towns, and we're talking German Mennonite towns. We are talking towns where they have never seen an African American. I mean, there's still towns there where I guarantee you an African American has not lived to this day, just because of geography and all that. But all these people knew was they loved baseball, and a lot of them played baseball throughout the summer. And these guys were coming up. They were real good. They, you know, were happy to be there. They mixed in with the community. And it really is a terrific part of Canadian history.
It is. And we look at the game today in its global capacity. And we talked a little bit about that on the show this morning. It's a global game today. But really at the heart of it, folks, were the Negro Leagues. They barnstormed into Canada. They were oftentimes the first Americans to play in many Spanish-speaking countries. It was a touring team of Negro Leaguers who took professional baseball to the Japanese in 1927. That's years before Ruth and his All-Stars go to Japan. They've been commonly credited with having taken it to the Japanese, but it's not true. A team called the Philadelphia Royal Giants go to Japan in 1927. They play a 24-game exhibition series. They go 23-0-1. On the tour was so successful that several years later, Ruth and his All-Stars would get invited. And I always preface that with our visitors at the museum because, again, for that same reason, is we look at the global aspect of this game, and at the forefront of that were the Negro Leagues. This was a very pioneering league. They were trendsetters. When you started, we talked about night baseball, but then advents such as the shin guard, the batting helmet, all these things originate from the Negro Leagues, and they never got credit for it. And so you can imagine when people come to Kansas City, this is an awakening. You know, all of a sudden, particularly for those of us who were born in the U.S. and we have to read U.S. history, yet there's this tremendous gap in the pages of U.S. history books. And one of them being this wonderful, rich story of the history of the Negro Leagues. And people, when they come there, they just leave, they're amazed by what they experience, but they're dismayed by the fact that I just now had an opportunity to learn this. Why didn't I learn this during my own formal education? And American historians have done us in the U.S. a terrible disservice. You know, they've tried to arbitrarily decide what we should know. And so museums like ours, essentially now, the goal is to rewrite the pages of those American history books, and hopefully world history books, because it's all prevalent. You know, I oftentimes tell people at the museum, if you don't control the pen, you don't control the story. So your story is never written with the kind of accuracy or relevancy that it should be. And so that great museum in Kansas City is about taking control of that pen and finally telling the story the way that it should have been told years prior.
Do we have time to open the floor for questions, Kev? Is that a,
we do.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
I'm sure.
I start running my mouth. We never.
No, it's good. No, I'm sure there are people out there who have questions.
Yeah, right here in the front.
First, could you talk for another 4 or 5 hours? Because that'd be awesome. There's something about Southern storytelling. But along those lines, has the Negro Museum done or are you planning to do any touring exhibitions?
We have 6. As a matter of fact, we're working with Kevin now to bring one to Toronto, so hopefully you'll see me real soon. Yeah, no, we do. We have 6 national and now hopefully international traveling exhibitions, all uniquely different, all tell stories about the history of the Negro Leagues through different lenses. And Kevin and I are talking right now about getting one of those traveling exhibitions to Toronto. I think there's a lot of interest and excitement, and so hopefully you guys will see me back here real soon the next time with a traveling exhibition. Yes,
sir.
Very
cool. All right.
Hi, Press. How you doing? So we all know about Jackie and breaking the Major League color barrier, but one that I'd like to know a little bit more from you is the story of how Hank Aaron integrated the Sally League, the South Atlantic League.
Yeah, it was tough for him, too.
Yeah, man. I mean, everybody thinks that Jackie had it tough.
Well, you know, and quite frankly, the guys who transitioned into the Major Leagues, it wasn't exactly easy for them, but when you compare it to those guys who had to make their way through the minor leagues, the Sally League, as he mentioned, and Hank's career, of course, began in the Negro Leagues with a team called the Indianapolis Clowns. And so Hank comes from Mobile, Alabama in 1952 to join the Indianapolis Clowns. We talked about it this morning. He was a skinny, cross-handed hitting infielder. Maybe weighed 170 pounds when he got there, if that's. And there's a picture in the museum. It's my favorite picture in the entire exhibition because Henry Aaron is my favorite baseball player of all time. I'm a native of Georgia, and so Hank, I was always a follower of Hank. And you know how baseball is. Whoever your favorite player was as a kid, he's going to be your favorite player for the rest of your life. You know, that's the beauty of baseball. And Hank, for me, is Hank. You know, and while everybody says Willie, I still say Hank, you know, because it's a game of numbers. And if it's a game of numbers, nobody's numbers are better than Hank. But anyway, this picture, Hank is standing at the train station in Mobile, and all he has is a duffel bag. And he told me, he says, Bob, I may have had 2 changes of clothes in that bag, $1.50 in my pocket, and a ham sandwich that my mama had made. And he's leaving home, maybe 18 years old, going to join the Indianapolis Clowns. Well, he tears it up. his first couple months with the Clowns. It wasn't very long before then the Boston Braves would sign him away from the Indianapolis Clowns. And so Boston Braves become the Milwaukee Braves, of course, become the Atlanta Braves. Well, Hank is sent to the Sally League. They had projected that it was going to take him 4 to 5 years to get to the major leagues. It took Hank less than 2 years to get there. And I'm telling you, the stuff that he went through down in the Sally League, it was fuel and motivation to try to hurry up and get out from down there, because it was brutal for those guys playing in those small southern towns. And there, I think there are still wounds with guys like Willie Mays and Hank Aaron for the way that they were treated in those little towns. And so they couldn't wait to get to the major leagues. And I think it is exemplary of their stick-to-itiveness, the passion, because it wasn't just about talent. There were guys who came from the Negro Leagues who didn't make it, but talent had nothing to do with it. It was their inability to deal with a social environment where nobody wanted you to be there. The players didn't want you there. The fans didn't want you there, to a large part, until you proved you could play. And once you proved that you could play, it broke down some of those stereotypical barriers that were there. See, Jackie, when Jackie comes up to the Dodgers, Jackie is completely different than the way he had been basically characterized. Black players were going to be aloof and flamboyant, and that's one of the reasons why you had to have a guy like Jackie Robinson, who was the complete opposite. College educated, served in the military, very workmanlike. See, Satchel could have been the first. Satchel would not have gone through what Jackie went through, because Satchel was a big star. But Satchel too closely adhered to that, I think, that stereotypical depiction of those African-American players. Satchel couldn't even be himself when he got to Cleveland. He couldn't do the things that he was known for. You know, he was so flat. He had these names for his pitches. You know, he didn't have fastball, changeup, curveball. No, he had the midnight crawler, the two-humper, the bat dodger, the hesitation pitch. He had what he called the long Tommy, which was his supersonic pitch. The short Tommy, which he said was just merely unhittable. And about 4 years ago, I'm in D.C. I know I'm running out of time, but we're in D.C., and I'm meeting with the Washington Nationals. And so after my meeting, they take me down on the field. I'm going to watch the Nats take batting practice. And so we get on the field. They introduce me to Davey Johnson, who at that time was the Nationals manager. He retired at the end of that season. So the minute he finds out who I am and where I'm from, the first words come out of his mouth: "Got to tell you my Satchel Paige story." Now, mind you, everywhere I go, somebody got a Satchel Paige story or a Buck O'Neill story. So I'm like, all right, man, let me hear your story. He says, "I faced Satchel for the first and only time in 1964. Now, in 1964, Satchel is either 58 or 68, depending on who you ask. And he says, Satchel walked me. But he says, after the game, I go in the dugout and I sit down next to Satchel and I say, well, Satchel, tell me, what's your best pitch? And he says, Satchel looks up at me and he smiles. He says, son, that would be my B-ball. And Johnson's looking just like you guys are, wondering, what the heck is a B-ball? Satchel says, it bees where I want it to be when I want it to be there. And so he did have in his arsenal of pitches his famous B-ball, but he couldn't bring that charisma to the major leagues because the major leaguers and Arturo and those guys were talking about it when they were up. That was showboating. You couldn't do that. But the late, great Buck O'Neill would characterize this whole ideology of showboating very simply. He says, it's only showboating when you can't do it. Amen, Buck.
All right, I'm not going to try to follow that up because I can't. So I'm going to ask for one more question before we've got to move on. All right, I'm going to come to the back of the room here. You've had your hand up for a while.
Thank you. So, Bob, we were kind of talking in the back before Pitch Talk started, and I just thought you could kind of share with everybody else what we were talking about in regards of the Negro League and the Cuban All-Stars, and even if you want to talk about Fidel Castro and his aspirations in baseball.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because on the slide I've got the great Martin DeHigo up on the screen, El Maestro, the master, because he could do it all. Played all nine positions, played all nine of them well. The only baseball player in the history of our sport in five different countries, baseball halls of fame, as you see on the screen, the Cuban, Mexican, Venezuelan, Dominican, and in Cooperstown. What got me, though, Arturo, one year in the Mexican League, 1938, he wins the pitching title. He goes 18-2 with an 0.90 ERA. The sucker wins the batting title that same season, hitting 387. That don't make any sense. That don't make any sense. But that connection to Cuba has always been very strong. And so Monty Irvin talked about Fidel Castro. And Castro, as Arturo well knows, was a pitcher down in Cuba. And Monty said he threw hard, but his control was all over the place. But it only leads you to wonder, if Castro had been a better baseball player, what would have happened in Cuba politically? Yeah, it could have changed the dynamics and the landmark of the political situation in Cuba if Castro had had better control.
And one thing before we go, we should touch on this as well, because it is important. The Negro Leagues, but also...
Who had that other question for me? The second question and the third.
Here, I'll come grab them.
I had to figure out some way to give them away.
But also,
Thank you. Wow. The
Latino players were also a factor in the Negro Leagues, weren't they?
Oh, of course. They found sanctuary playing in the Negro Leagues. So when these men went down to those Spanish-speaking countries, they were welcome. They stayed in the finest hotels that those countries had to offer. They ate in the finest restaurants. Well, the dark-skinned Spanish-speaking athlete couldn't play in the major leagues either. So when they came to the U.S., they found sanctuary playing in the Negro Leagues. So it created this cultural bond that is so strong through baseball. Matter of fact, one of the traveling exhibitions that we have right now is called Negro Leagues Baseball, the Spanish spelling of that word, and it's written in both bilingually in English and Spanish. And it celebrates about 12 Spanish-speaking countries that called the Negro Leagues home at one point in time. So there was a strong relationship between the Negro Leagues and Spanish-speaking countries. And these, number one, because they could play. And the fans adored them. In Puerto Rico, the great Willard Brown, Ese Hombre, that man. Yeah, won the Triple Crown in Puerto Rico twice. Willard Brown was just as beloved in Puerto Rico as Roberto Clemente was beloved in Puerto Rico. And Roberto Clemente's idol, Monty Irvin. Roberto Clemente used to carry Monty Irvin's uniform to the ballpark to get in the ballpark. If some kid carried the player uniform, he let you in free. And Roberto Clemente carried the great Monty Irvin's uniform so he could get into the ballpark. And Roberto Clemente Jr. told me that Monty Irvin gave his dad his first baseball glove, real baseball glove. Wow. And the rest is history.
We could probably keep this going all night. Bob, thank you so much for coming.
It was
a real pleasure. And as I said, you know, go online, find out information about the museum, and if you are ever in Kansas City, by all means, you owe it to yourself to go to the Negro League Museum.
And Bob, when that exhibition comes to town, I guarantee every person in this room will be bringing at least three people to come with them to come and see it. We'll make it happen. No pressure, Kevin. No pressure. Ladies and gentlemen, the president of the Negro Baseball League Museum, Bob Kendrick and Jeff Blair. Thank you very much, gentlemen.